about 1,933 years ago, the Jews made a mistake. And that led to what's happening outside this room right now. That led to the situation we're in. There's a Talmudic passage in Tractate Yuma that hints to what the possible mistake might be. The Gemara there asks the following question. The Gemara says, why was the first Beis Hamikdash, the first temple, destroyed? And the Gemara answers with confidence. There were three causes. The Jews were involved in idol worship. They were involved in illicit sexual relations. And they were involved in murder. So the Gemara accepts that answer and then asks, but if that's what destroys temples, then why was the second temple destroyed? After all, during the period of the second temple, the people were learning Torah and they were keeping mitzvahs. And the Gemara even goes so far as to say they were involved in gemilut chasadim, in kindness. So what could have possibly been the cause? And the Gemara answers that at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, 1,933 years ago, the Jews were also involved in something called Sinat Chinam, unjustified hatred, free, needless, gratuitous hatred. We're in the most profound state of mourning that we achieve during the entire year today because the Jews are involved in needless hatred. The Talmud Yerushalmi makes this very clear. The Talmud Yerushalmi says, in any generation, any Tisha B'Av that arrives, and the temple has not been rebuilt, it's because the people, the Jews who were alive in that generation, destroyed it again. Now, who are the Jews who are destroying the temple? You can't point your finger at those Jews who are so assimilated that they barely know that they're Jews, because they can't be expected to know that there's an obligation not to be involved in gratuitous hatred. They couldn't possibly know any of the laws of Lashon Hara, any of the laws which restrict hateful speech, which is also responsible for the destruction of the temple. So those who are completely assimilated, they're off the hook. It's not their fault. Clearly, they're not the ones who destroyed it. And it would be very difficult to point at the masses of Reformed conservative Jews as well. Because the truth is, they don't know. They've just been deprived of quality Jewish education. They couldn't possibly know what's going wrong. And they certainly wouldn't know how to fix it. So if that's the case, so then who's really responsible? So unfortunately, and it's an embarrassment for me to say, but it's me. And it's you. And it's we who know. When we look around, those of us who know, who truly understand that that's the root of the problem. So you look around, people seem like they care. I mean, certainly in our circles, people speak about how it's terrible to have gratuitous hatred. And we attend programs like this. So what's going wrong? Like, where's the Beis HaMikdash? Why didn't Mashiach come today? When I got up this morning, my wife looked at me and she said, I can't believe Mashiach didn't come. What more do we have to do? What's wrong? So I have a theory, which I'll try out on you. My theory is like this. I'd like to propose that there is a widespread disorder, call it a psychological disorder or a spiritual disorder, and masses of people who know how bad gratuitous hatred is, masses of those people are infected with this disorder. It's not ADD. It's not ADHD. It's called 2DS, two-dimensional syndrome. I think there's masses of people who only see things in two dimensions, even though they're living in a three-dimensional world. I'll try to explain what 2DS is. If you could imagine a creature that was locked into two dimensions, they could only detect things within a plane. So most of what exists in the world they would never notice, because all those things flying around out in three dimensions, since it's above their plane, they don't even see them. And when something passes through their plane, they don't really see what's there. All they see are lines, but the whole three-dimensional picture they miss. Without giving away entirely what 2DS is, I'd like to give some tests for 2DS. What we'll do is we'll all take the test together, and then we'll analyze the results here in public, and we'll see how we come out. I'll give you some clinical tests and then some situational tests. We'll start with these clinical exams. Exam number one. The written Torah, we know, contains 613 categories of mitzvahs. And the oral law explains that within these 613 categories, there's really about 15,000 little details. Now, just for a minute, let's contemplate some of these details. There's a law that when you're eating a mixture of peas and corn on Shabbat, if you like the peas and you don't like the corn, you must be careful to separate the peas from the corn. But God forbid, the law of Borer prohibits separating out what you don't like, the corn, and leaving the peas. You must always take the good from the bad on Shabbat, not the bad from the good. An itsy bitsy little halacha. Give you another one. When you put on your shoes, the right shoe goes before the left shoe. I'll give you another one. Even if you're left-handed, the right shoe goes before the left shoe. There's a Jewish law that when Shabbat ends, you must sit down and make a little party. Minimally, you have to wash and eat bread. I'll give you another law. On Shabbat, one is not allowed to talk about politics or business. our other mundane things. Our speech in Shabbat has to be elevated. I'll give you another example. I've got to give 10% of my net after taxes to charity. Not 9 or 7, but 10. Up to 20. Minimally 10. Now let me take the test. And let me try to answer the question honestly. Does it ever occur to me, oh, come on. Does God really care if I separate the corn from the peas or the peas from the corn? What's the difference? If I flip a light switch on Shabbos, that like violates the holiness of the Sabbath? Come on, what's the problem? If I give 9.9%, I'm a bad person? What's the problem here? If I put on my left shoe before my right shoe? If I don't live up to all the details of the system, have I in some way betrayed God and His Torah? Come on! What kind of religion is this? Do such thoughts ever occur to me? 2DS, clinical test number one. We'll grade these tests in a few minutes. Let's go on to 2DS test number two. The Code of Jewish Law reveals the following bizarre halacha. When Arabs pray, they scream. When Christians pray, they kneel quietly. When Jews pray, says the Code of Jewish Law, the Jew must speak. But specifically, the Jew must whisper his or her prayers. Does it ever occur to me, oh, come on, why do I have to say the words of the Siddur? Why whisper them? Can't I just think them? I mean, doesn't God know what's in my heart? Isn't He omniscient? What kind of a crazy law is this that I've got to whisper the words? Does that ever occur to me? 2DS test number one, does it ever bother me there's so much detail in Judaism? 2DS number two, does it ever bother me that I have to speak in tefillah? QDS number three. When one first becomes involved in Judaism, very often we're introduced to the most beautiful of the Torah's mitzvahs. Or another way of saying that, very often we're introduced to those mitzvahs that are most compatible with my Western values. It's a good sales pitch. But I remember a year or two or five down the line discovering Jewish laws that were not compatible with my Western values. Jewish laws which at best seemed inane. And I'll confess, at worst, sometimes these Jewish laws seemed to me immoral. In total conflict with the Western values I was raised with. When it comes to one of these sorts of laws, do I hesitate? Is there a voice inside of my head that says, you know, I want to be a good Jew, and I also want to be a good person? And in this case, being the good person takes priority, and I think I'd just rather not participate. Or more common case, do I justify my laziness by saying that, you know, this is not exactly part of my value system anyways? And in that way, I can walk away from the mitzvah. 2DS test number three. even though we know that the Jews at Mount Sinai cried out, Naseh v'nishma, we'll do things even if we don't understand them. Do I sometimes feel uncomfortable with that principle? 2DS test number one. Does the detail drive me crazy? 2DS test number three. Am I bothered that I have to speak in tefillah when I pray? And 2DS test number three. Am I sometimes uncomfortable with this principle, Naseh v'nishma, I'll do it even if I don't understand it? Now let's analyze the tests. I just have to provide you with the key for the tests. Once you have the key, you'll have no problem doing the analysis. There is a Talmudic passage which poses a riddle. I'm going to give you the riddle. The Talmud does not resolve the riddle, so I'm not going to resolve it for you either, at least not initially. But I will pose the riddle. The Talmud asks the following question. The Talmud says, let the Yadid come. A Yadid is a dear one, a close one. In Hebrew, all words are based on either two-letter roots or three-letter roots. But the word Yadid,
Yud-Dalet,
is four letters. So it can't be that this is a Hebrew root. It must be that this is either a three-letter root that's been conjugated, or it's two-letter roots. Of course, those who know Hebrew understand that really this is a two-letter root. The word is yad. And when it's yad b'yad, when we're holding hands, that's called a yadid, a dear one. The Talmud starts, let the dear one come. The son of the dear one. And let him build a dear thing in the portion of the dear one. And their dear ones will achieve atonement. Once again, let the dear one come, the son of the dear one. And let him build a dear thing in the portion of the dear one, and their dear ones will achieve atonement. What's this talking about? So the only way to decode this is to get out of concordance. If you get out of concordance and you start flipping through the Tanakh, the Bible, and looking for every place someone is called a dear one, you have all the answers. Let the dear one come. This is King Solomon. The descendant of the dear one, Abraham, is also called a Yadid. Let King Solomon, descendant of Abraham, come. And let him build a dear thing. The Beit HaMikdash is called Mayididus, how this wonderful dear thing that we have down the middle of the old city. Let King Solomon, son of Abraham, come and build the Beit HaMikdash in the portion of the Yadid. Benjamin was called the dear one. Yadid Hashem, the dear one of God. In Benjamin's portion of the land of Israel, the whole land of Israel is divided up among the tribes. This is the portion of Benjamin. And their dear ones will come and receive atonement, and that's talking about you and me, the Jews. This is the Jewish worldview. That we live in an olam, a world of yididut, a world of dearness, of closeness, of intimacy, of oneness, of connection. That's our vision. Those who live in three dimensions are aware that the third dimension is connection, relationship. In two dimensions is functionality, efficiency. Let's get it done. Let's move things forward. Let's make money. Let's build bridges. A better pacemaker. A new tape recorder. That's all in two dimensions. And then there's this third human dimension. No, a third godlike dimension. The dimension of Yadidus, of connection. what's the germ that infects humanness and smashes people into two dimensions? So the Gemara explains it. The Gemara in Tractate Shabbos says like this. Someone who tears his clothing in anger, or who breaks things when he gets angry, people slam doors or smash cups or things like this, or someone who destroys money in anger, they tear up checks or bills, throw money down the toilet. This person should be in your eyes like someone who worships Avodah Zarah. For the moment, I won't translate those words. I think people usually translate it as idol worship. I think that's probably not a good translation. For the moment, we would translate the words Avodah Zarah. The Gemara asks, where do you see a prohibition in the Torah on this thing, Avodah Zarah, what you and I would translate as idol worship? And you and I would probably cite the second commandment, you should have no other gods before me. But the Gemara doesn't. The Gemara cites another verse. Lo yeh becha, there shouldn't be within you El Zar, the God of Zar. The Gemara asks, who is the God of Zar who dwells within a person? And the Gemara answers, Ze Yetzihara. This is the evil inclination. What's this thing, El Zar? That word Zar, in English, Z-A-R, in Hebrew, Zayin Reish. It's a word that anyone who has traveled in Israel has seen. It's from the word zarut. Zarut is estrangement, distance, disconnection. Where do you see this in modern Israel? So, in a building where they have private parking, and they don't want strangers to park there, so they'll put up a sign that says, Ein chanaya, there is no parking, le for zarim. Those people who are not connected to us, those people who are distant. Go back to that word again. When someone is involved in two dimensions, the Gemara says they're involved in something called avodah zara. That doesn't mean idol worship. The word idol is nowhere there. Avodah means the work, the service of, the bowing to zara, zarut, disconnection, isolation, aloneness. What's the germ that drives human beings into the second dimension? It's called fear of intimacy, fear of closeness, fear of relationship with God, with other people, often with ourselves, we're afraid of making connection. Turns out there's two gods we can worship. The God of Yididus, the God of intimacy. Or if we don't like that, we can always worship the God of two dimensions. Fear of intimacy, running away, disconnection. The Talmud's claim is that every single Torah law, every single one of them, is designed to create yedidus, intimacy, connection, closeness. That's the claim. And every single violation of Torah law drives a person into two dimensions, into a flat world. Now, this is a provocative claim for anyone who lives in two dimensions. Those who live in two dimensions are like, what are you talking about? Where are you going? So let's go back and grade the exams. The clinical exams. In a moment we'll move to the situational exams. Why so much detail? It bothers me sometimes. Such picky little detail. So these days I do a lot of marriage counseling. And when couples come to talk to me, rarely do they come because things are wonderful. It happens occasionally. It's a wonderful experience when they come for that reason. They just want a good piece of advice here or there to make things better. But usually when people come, they're coming because things are on the rocks. So I kid you not, when I ask them, like, what's wrong? I get the craziest responses. He squeezes the toothpaste tube right in the middle. He never starts in the back and rolls up. She doesn't like that when he uses the toilet, he always forgets to put the seat back down again. These are real complaints I get. This is the reason for a divorce. I had a guy, I'd known him for 10 years, seemed like a perfectly normal, psychologically healthy person until, right, he told me that he was having problems with his marriage. What was the problem? His wife didn't like his beard. That's it, I'm gonna divorce her! She won't let me grow a beard, I'm out of here! Insanity! Over the littlest things. I've never met a couple that was getting a divorce because she's a Republican, I'm a Democrat. He forgot my 25th anniversary. It's never over big things. It's never over big things. It's never over things like that. It's always over small things. And when the couples come who have a good marriage, I say, can you give us a pointer? I always say, can you give me a pointer? It's going well, tell me, what do I do? And invariably, he'll say something like, you know what I love? I love the fact that when I come home, she always greets me at the door. And there's this big smile. And sometimes she makes me a cup of tea. And I'll say to her, what do you love about him? And she'll say, because he remembers. Not just that I love roses. He always remembers I love the yellow roses and the pink ribbon. And he never forgets that white fluffy stuff that goes into the baby's breath. He knows I love that stuff. It's not the roses. It's that he remembered the yellow roses. It's the detail. All relationships rise or fall based on detail. So a person living in three dimensions, they're not shocked when they find and tour tremendous detail. Of course there's tremendous detail there. That's what relationships are all about. And more. If I want to fall in love, I need to take care of those details for my beloved. I need my wife, Hannah, to every now and then slip and let me know what details she loves so I can take care of those things for her. And God sort of unravels in front of us this scroll, my 613 favorite things, and says, have a fun time. That's mitzvahs. If I'm shocked by the fact there's lots of detail, it's because I'm living in two dimensions. Of course there's lots of detail. In every relationship there's lots of detail. So of course in Torah there's lots of detail. How else are you going to fall in love with God? Second test. It bothers me that I have to talk to God. Jewish sources talk about two different types of speech. Masculine speech and feminine speech. Now, men engage also in feminine speech, and women engage also in masculine speech. It's just that men are more expert at masculine speech and women are more expert at feminine speech. Generally, with exceptions. What's masculine speech? Excuse me, could you please pass the ketchup? No. I'll take out the trash. Who's going to pay the water bill? That's masculine speech. It's effective. It gets things done. It's two-dimensional. What's feminine speech? women have an intuitive sense that not just does conversation create closeness, but specifically the act of speaking to somebody creates within you a feeling of intimacy. Not the act of being spoken to, the act of speaking to. The more that you speak to somebody, the closer you feel to them. Very often, if you watch a couple walking down the street, the man will be nodding his head, and the woman will be speaking to him. It's very common. Sometimes you'll see two women walking down the street, they'll both be talking simultaneously. There's nothing wrong with that. They're drawing close. By speaking to somebody, that's how you draw close to them. For someone who lives in two dimensions, it's very difficult to understand why I have to talk to God. I mean, he knows what's in my heart. Let's be functional about things. Why waste energy to articulate it? But if you want to fall in love with him, of course you have to talk. If you want to draw close to somebody, you always have to talk to them. And by the way, that's also why we whisper. My teacher pulled me aside. He's giving me marriage advice. And he said, Leigh, if you want to be close to your wife, you got to take her out. Every now and then, he said, at least once a month, you got to take her out. Go to a nice restaurant where you have no students. Little table in the back. Some candles. And he gave me an interesting piece of advice. He said, Leigh, during the entire day, whisper. Why? What happens when you whisper? What kind of environment does that create? A closeness, an intimacy. Someone who lives in two dimensions, they won't understand why I'm whispering to God. But someone who lives in three dimensions, it's clear. This is relationship. This is intimacy. This is closeness. The third 2DS test. What about when I don't understand what God asks of me? It doesn't make sense to me. This mitzvah is illogical. It conflicts with everything I've been raised with. A couple of years ago, the secretary at work brought me a message from my wife. She handed me the note. I read the note. The note said, Leigh, Hannah requests that after work, you pick up some whole wheat flour for her. Now imagine if my reaction to the whole wheat flour is, what? Whole wheat flour? What a chutzpah! Why would she want whole wheat flour? I run over the telephone, dial the phone. No answer! What a chutzpah! If I can't figure it out, I'm not going to buy it for her. If that's my response, you realize I have a bad case of 2DS. I can't understand the functionality, so I refuse. Now, what should I do? So here's the true end of the story. After work, I went down to the makolet, the little 7-Eleven. I said, could I have some whole wheat flour? Okay, so we don't sell whole wheat flour here. You got to go to a health food store 15 minutes from here in town. And with a big smile on my face, I had pleasure in getting on the bus for Hannah to go pick up whole wheat flour. Because I love her. I walk into the health food store. Could I please have some whole wheat flour? The guy says, oh. I said, what's wrong? He said, we just sold our last bag. I said, oh. He said, but 15 minutes from here, if you walk, there's another health food store, they'll have it. He said, could you call, please? He calls, they've got it. I said, put aside two bags for me. I run across town, panting. I run into the second health food store. Do you have the whole wheat flour? He says, yes, it's right here. He hands me the two bags of whole wheat flour. Sitting on the checkout counter are carob bars. My wife loves carob. I take the whole wheat flour, a handful of carob bars, put it on the table. I check out, I grab the whole bag, I run out. On the way back to the bus, I pass the flower stand. I bought her the yellow roses with the pink ribbon. and the white stuff. And I showed up at the door. It's me, sweetie. I brought the whole wheat flour. Why did Chana want whole wheat flour? I don't know. It's not that I don't care why she brought wanted the whole wheat flour. I do care. Because if you really love somebody, you want to get inside their head, crawl around, discover everything about them. But it's not like until I discover why she wants the whole wheat flour, I'm going to refuse. If you're in two dimensions, if you're being functional and efficient, then when you don't understand, you don't do. But if you're in love, if it's a relationship, if there's a third dimension, then you don't have to understand. Why did I buy it for her? Because she asked. Because I love her. Because I know this makes her happy. Why does it drive God crazy when I flip on lights on Shabbos? I don't know. Honest, I don't know. And it's not that I don't care. I look forward to someday discovering why. But it's not like I'm going to refuse to keep Shabbos until I figure out why. That's 2DS. We're low on time, so I'll just give you one, maybe two, situational tests for 2DS. I'm going to describe to you some real scenarios, and as I describe this to you, they will sound crazy to you. Or perhaps not. If you're slipping into three dimensions now, everything will make sense. There are two women who each live about, one about a 10-minute walk, one about a 30-minute walk from where we're sitting. One of them is a young woman who was raised in America, went looking for spirituality, discovered Hinduism, meditated in an ashram for 12 years. Another is a woman who was raised in an Orthodox home in Eastern Europe, who at 16 years old was put on a train for Auschwitz. When she arrived at Auschwitz, this woman was selected by Mengele to be a toy for the war. And he did all sorts of terrible experiments on her. I won't describe any of them, but you can imagine it's disgusting. These two women got together about 5 years ago and had a conversation. And the woman who lived in the ashram told over the stories of her time in the ashram. After 12 years there, she met a Rav, left the ashram, became a traditional Jew. And the woman from Auschwitz told over her story. And at the end, they sat looking at each other, and the woman from Auschwitz turned towards the woman from the ashram. And the woman from Auschwitz said, "The ashram, where you meditated for 12 years, it was a bad place." And the woman who was in the ashram just nodded yes. Then the woman from Auschwitz continued. "Auschwitz," she said, "Auschwitz was a good place. The ashram was a bad place. Auschwitz was a good place." And the young lady from the West looked at her like she was crazy and said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Don't you see? When they put us on the train for Auschwitz, we knew where we were headed. We knew when we arrived there, they would strip us, they would take everything away from us. So on the train, I had a sitter, and I sat and I memorized the Yom Kippur davening, so there'd be somebody to pray for the Jews on Yom Kippur, someone would know the tefillahs. My best friend, she memorized the Rosh Hashanah davening. There was a girl right next to us in the train, she memorized Megillat Esther, so there would be somebody to read the Megillah on Purim. Don't you see, in Auschwitz, we lived every moment for each other. We loved, we took care of. Not everybody made it, but everybody lived for each other. To translate her words, we all lived in three dimensions. For 12 years in the ashram, you selfishly meditated. You had no concern for anybody but yourself, your own sense of inner peace. Don't you see, the ashram was a bad place. If the world looked any different to us before today, it's because we were stuck in 2DS. Tell you one last story. A situational test. Not too long ago, there was a woman on tour who was coming through the Old City, and she was approached by a rabbi who said, "Would you be interested in visiting an Orthodox women's seminary?" And the lady said, "I don't know. I've never been to an Orthodox women's seminary. Do they have rabbis there?" And the rabbi said, "Yeah." So she said, "In that case, I'd very much like to visit an Orthodox women's seminary. Could you take me to one?" And the rabbi walked her back to his car and drove her from here in the Old City out to the seminary where I work. She came in, everybody was busy, I was not busy. She came in and she sat with me. And I said, "How can I help you?" And she said to me, "Are you Orthodox?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "I need to ask you a question." She said, "When I leave Israel, I'm flying out on Sunday. I'm going home and I'm going to have a surgery, an elective surgery that will ensure that I never have children. And I just want to know, how do you feel about that?" So I looked at her and I said, "What do you expect me to say? It's not a stupid woman. What do you expect me to say?" She said, "I think you're going to tell me that I shouldn't do it." So I said, "And if I told you that you shouldn't do it, what would you say?" And the tears welled up in her eyes. And she said to me, "I would tell you that you're insane! What's wrong with you people? Don't you feel the pain? Don't you see what's happening out there in the world? This hellhole that we were born into? The hunger, the physical hunger, the emotional hunger. Nobody gets enough love. And you want me to bring another child into this world? What's wrong with you?" I just put down my head. And I thought. And I looked up at her. And I said, "Imagine the following. You're a freshman in high school. You just arrived in high school. High school is an exciting place. Much more exciting than junior high. And everyone's having a fun time. But you have a dream. And so every day at 3:15 when they let you out of school, you go home and you crack open those books and you study till 7, 8 o'clock at night. Finish off your freshman year with a 3.8 GPA. Dream's getting a little closer. Sophomore year, people are having parties all night. Some people are starting to get their driver's licenses. Everyone's having so much fun, but you have a dream. Every night, 3:15, you go home, you open up the books, you crack them. From 3:15 till 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, you're studying. Sophomore year, 4.0. The dream is getting close. junior year in high school, the year that counts. You're up every night till midnight. These people are involved in student government, they're having fun. These people are involved in sports. But you have a dream. First semester, junior year, 4.0. Second semester, 4.0. You take the SATs, 1,600. Pin the needles. It's getting close. Middle of your senior year, you get the letter. Congratulations. You've been accepted to UCLA. Dream's getting closer. You go off to UCLA. Everybody at UCLA has been doing what you've been doing for the last 4 years. All the people who are messing around are gone. The competition's terrible. Freshman year, you stumble, 3.2. Sophomore year, you figure out till midnight the library is not enough, it's got to be till 2. 3.9. Junior year, 4.0. MCATs, you pin the needles. You file your applications. Middle of senior year, the letter comes. Congratulations, you've been accepted to Harvard Medical School. The dream is almost within reach. It's been 8 long years. You arrive at Harvard, first year orientation, they tell you 30% of the incoming class will be dropped after the first year. Everybody is up till 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. You walk around with a constant headache. You never stop studying, on the bus, in the elevator. You barely make it into the final exams at Harvard. And when you complete your last exam, you go and sleep for a week. They post the names of everyone who made it through freshman year. You walk into the hallway, and after 9 years of work, you're scanning the names looking for your name. There it is. You made it. Second year medical school. They tell you they're going to drop another 30%. You're up till 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, sleeping an hour or two a night, coffee, IV. You never rest. Hands shaking, you slide into final exams. A week later, you go into that hallway, you look, you find your name. Yes, coursework is done, clinical work, 24-hour shifts, 72-hour shifts. You don't know if you're going to make it. Internship, residency. It's been 16 years. I can't believe it's been 16 years. I've been waiting 16 years for this moment. I can't believe I'm here in the locker room, the Yale emergency room. I just finished suiting up as an emergency room doctor. And I'm about to go in. I can't believe it. And take over as the chief physician of the Yale emergency room. It's been 16 years I've been waiting for this dream. As I walk out of the locker room, I start heading towards those double doors, and I'm walking down the road. Suddenly someone bursts through the double doors. It's a doctor. He comes out screaming, "My God, it's terrible in there, it's terrible!" I say, "What's wrong, what's wrong?" He says, "Horrible, there's people with limbs hanging off, gunshot wounds, stab wounds, everyone's crying. It's a nightmare in there." And I look at him like he's crazy. And I tell him, "My friend, that's not a nightmare. That's my dream." And you walk in and you start healing people. I said to this woman, "If you came here to take, then this world is a nightmare. There isn't enough love. There's not enough water, and there's not enough food. Everybody needs. But if you came here to give, this world is a dream." It could be that even though that we understand that gratuitous hatred is the symptom, we can't work on it until we identify the actual disease. And it could be that the disease is 2DS. Is that we've been so trained to pursue efficiency and productivity that we forgot that the whole goal of life is relationship. But I have a lot of hope, because I think the world is waking up. And I think more and more people are desperate for relationship. And more people are desperate for closeness. And it could be now, more than ever before, not only are we ready to hear the message that this life is really about living in three dimensions, but it could be that if you take that message back home, if you bring the message from Yerushalayim, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, if you bring the lesson of Torah back from Yerushalayim, it could be there'll be a lot of people back home who are all ready to get cured of 2DS and move into three dimensions. And then it could be the next year, when we meet again here, we'll be celebrating the coming of Mashiach.